It's 2300 Zulu, and this is SCARS, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This net is conducted under the guidelines of the SCARS organization and further follows the rules outlined in FCC Part 97 and Good Amateur Practice. This SCARS server is supplied by the Great Lakes Reflector System, provided by KB8ZGL, and all contacts and requests for information will be handled through the net control. When you contact with another station is made, please move off the system and establish your contact direct so the net may continue. In fairness to all, short-time stations will not be recognized as such. All stations will be worked in the order in which they checked in. Information regarding our operation may be found at the scarsvoip.com website. Let me buy a nickel. My name is Gary. My call is KC2GA. I'm located in Syracuse, New York's beautiful Outer Comstock section, that is, with a temperature of 35 degrees and about 18 inches of snow on the ground right now. Now, prior to starting, I'd like to ask if there's any emergency traffic or anything out of the ordinary that needs to be handled at this time. Nothing heard. Do we have anyone celebrating their birthday this week? No birthdays, so as Kathy always says, nobody's getting any older. That's a good thing. So what's going on? Well, this is the monthly Thursday Informational Net Open Forum, or TIN for short. Now, this net is conducted to provide information pursuant to amateur-related subjects and or other areas of general interest to those participating. All are encouraged to participate and ask questions of our guest speaker or speakers. Now, let me advise all stations connected that this net might be recorded for future presentation on our website as a podcast. All stations participating will be a part of that recording. Okay, having gotten the preliminaries out of the way here, we are using a headline news format to do a spring cleaning of radio-related topics affecting operations and equipment, including transceivers, computers, and even ourselves as operators and listeners. Levi Nickel, we'll go into this a little further. We want to take a humorous look at our hobby and ourselves and to make ourselves better operators and better equipped to serve the public we are responsible to serve. Now, while we laugh, we hope to become more knowledgeable in how to operate and maintain our stations in the public interest. We'll take a tongue-in-cheek look at how to clean the crud off the inside walls of your equipment semiconductors that builds up all those electron rag chews gumming up the insides. We might even take a poke at quantum computing in the process. Now, caution, do not use that procedure. So, grab your coffee, your tea, your ice cream, your cake, and donuts. No cigarettes, please. We're cleaning up the shack today. And feel free to check in and check out the live picture courtesy of Steve, KF5VH, for tonight's picture worthy of making into a closet door poster in your station. Now, as always, this is a reminder that trademarked and patented names in the tin remain the property of the owner. No commercial interest or endorsement is intended, and we are only concerned with how to make our radio operations more secure in the public and emergency communications service part of our hobby, in accord with good operating practices and compliant with all FCC regulations. Buying a nickel. Now, on with the headlines. W4RFJ has a breaking news headline for us out of Puerto Rico, affecting our radio family. Thus, we will have a headline dispatch from the desk of KY6V about our South Cars family and conference. W4RFJ from KC2GA, please update us on Puerto Rico.
KC2GA and 070 substituting for W4FJ. Permission to proceed, over.
Permission granted, good sir.
Well, good evening to everyone on the TIN tonight. Our late-breaking headlines tonight are actually three. At first, two. Number one, if you happen to use VMware for your virtual machines. There was an update released today that you may want to be sure and grab that deals with the malware, which we'll be discussing later. The big news also, the Arecibo Radio Astronomy Observatory in Puerto Rico has attained a new lease on operational life. The University of Central Florida plans to take responsibility for the operations and management of Arecibo Observatory. The observatory requires a large amount of capital to recover from the significant Hurricane Maria damage from last September. And also, second from the news line yesterday, the new Spring Raspberry Pi 3B Plus has been released with greater processing power and Wi-Fi dual band capability. So more on these headlines later in the TIN. And back to you, Gary. KC2GA in the TIN, NO70.
It's KC2GA. And those are some kind of pretty exciting news tidbits there. I dabble into VMware from time to time, and I'm always happy to hear about a new release on Raspberry Pi, because, again, it's one of those things I like to fire up every now and then and fool around with. So I'm bating my breath and waiting for the rest of the story on those. That sounds very, very interesting. Hey, what do you say right now? We call for some check-ins, some comments. Just let us know that you're there. Say hello and welcome to the Thursday Informational Network. I'm KC2GA. This is Southcars, and we're looking for check-ins right now.
Sierra United November.
Well, we had Sierra United November. Hello there, Kathy. It is great to hear your voice. Anybody else want to come in at this time?
Okay, yeah. X-Ray, Charlie, X-Ray. Good morning.
This is H-A.
Station calling, try again. You are breaking up.
Hotel Alpha.
Yeah, for some reason you're very choppy. You're breaking up. So let's get to these two check-ins, and then we're going to try to get to you at the end. Hopefully whatever's causing you your trouble will be taken care of at the end. So K6SUN, hello there, Miss Sunshine. It's great to hear your voice.
Well, good evening, Gary. Thanks so much for running, introducing tonight. This is Kathleen. I'm in the great state of Michigan, Kalkaska, Michigan, to be exact, where it is currently 23 degrees, and it's snowing pretty heavily. I'm here with my mom and my son, Gary, spending some time. So I thought I'd check in this evening and say hello to everyone. But I'll be in the background listening. Hopefully I'm sounding okay through the laptop speaker, but I did want to check in. So I'll turn it back to you, Gary. Please stay warm in Syracuse as we are staying warm in Michigan. Back to you from Kilo 6 Sierra United November.
Thank you, Kathy. Hey, quick question for you. How much snow do you have there in Upperland?
Well, Gary, I'm really not sure. It's been snowing for a couple days, but it's just really snow flurries. My son is going to be in a hunting and fishing expo because he started a new business. So he took some equipment over, and it's been snowing all day. As far as quantity, I don't know. It's probably about 6 inches, maybe 8 inches. But very, very snowy at this point. So the sooner it leaves, Gary, the better off I'll be. Back to you.
Thank you, Kathy. We've got 18 inches on the ground here now. We are expecting another nor'easter or possibly two next week. So if we survive that, we'll let you know. Thanks again for checking in. Let's move it along to X-Ray Charlie. X-Ray, hello. And welcome to the TIN.
Good evening to you. This is Woody in 5, X-Ray Charlie X-Ray from Mount Dora, Florida, where Kathleen, eat your heart out, girl. I'm 67 degrees. I'm sure your hubby's a little higher than that. Isn't that nice? It's good to hear you, though. You have a very good evening. And tell your mom hi for me, too. Well, and are you just giving H.A. a hard time because he's Fred? This is N5HCX. Stand by. Back to net.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. Anybody else out there want to dive in before we move things along? We'll take one more call for check-ins.
This is Kilowatt 2 Hotel America.
Okay, that's the station we were having troubles with. Try one more time. You're very choppy. We get like a little piece of what you're saying, and then you fade. So try going. Just give us your calls very slowly. We'll try again.
Info 6 Victor.
Go right ahead, 6 Victor.
Gary, I'm not having any problems on this end with Fred. That's K2HA. It's something between Syracuse and Philly, I'm guessing. Over.
Yeah, must be. It's very choppy. I'm just getting like every other word on them. I'm going to say, Fred, just go ahead. If folks can hear you, go right ahead. And I may not be able to get every word, but we'll work around it as best as we can.
Well, thank you, Gary. The weather in beautiful, I'm in Ardmore right now and up on the fourth floor of the church trying to get as close to the satellite as possible for your benefit, Gary. And we are just about ready to do choir practice. And my wife has arrived safely from the Palm Beach Airport into Philly, and the dogs are happy. This is Fred, K2HA.
All right, well, Fred, you know, I got a couple words worth from you. So appreciate you checking in, and hopefully you'll stick around, and hopefully that bit of a problem will clear up as the night progresses. So thanks for being there. As we go on to our next item, Gordon, KY6V, has some observations about the direction of South Cars, including its future practices, procedures, stations recruitments, and volunteer recruitment. Now he, Kathy, K6SUN, and me have reviewed feedback received over the past few weeks from South Cars members, including KJ4PUJ, UA3QGN, and other South Cars members. So, Gordon, if you'd be kind enough to come on and tell us a little bit about that.
I'd be pleased to. Hello there, Maestro. Thank you. Hi to my bride in Michigan. A quick comment. Fred, if you're still listening, I think the problem with you and Gary is your audio level is extremely hot. It is not clipping on my end, but maybe clipping on Gary's equipment. That's just a guess, guys and gals. Well, at any rate, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this evening's TIN. I, along with some of our board members, will be opening the first segment by a brief overview on how your board of directors are currently working on thoughts for how SCARS may make improvements in its operational policies and promotional efforts for the future. Now, this effort started in early February when we launched a statistical study of our databases. And we were looking at key segments to see if we could identify trends in the various complex data available. And for starters, we looked at, and let me buy a nickel before I go into that, recharge everybody's timers. We looked at what license class do our members fall in. We looked at what license class holds the popularity in membership. We looked at what was the trend as to what part of the year by month when new members joined us. We looked at what is the membership level for foreign countries. And I will add that we did an extensive website evaluation on the number of views of our site, the number of contacts, if you will, the popular pages that were looked at, the maintenance records and how much downtime we may or may not have had, and other reviews were made. So, at this point, we are marching towards the goal. It is still early to tell, you know, how this exercise is going to turn out. But at the moment, we are starting to concentrate on some areas that look promising. Let me retime, please. So some of these early thoughts follow here. We know that the highest month of for new membership registration is the month of January. We know that the lowest month of registration is in June. Now, I want to amplify that this is a statistical study over a 10-year period. Now, we're just not looking at 1 year. We're looking at 10. And we also learn that the middle of the road of this registration occurs in the fall. So by activating a membership drive campaign during the low periods and offering special incentives for enrolling may help. Some of these incentives might include free membership certificates, promoting their enrollment with pictures on the homepage, website, and et cetera, et cetera. We know at this point that there are some improvements that can be made. I'm checking the screen here to make sure I'm not getting close to timeout. Some improvements that can be made on the way we are currently promoting and handling our free licensed classes. That's the outreach program. I will buy another nickel at this point. Although we ask each student, at the end of our South Cars licensing course, so please let us know when you take the test and whether you've passed, and if so, you know, what your new call may be. Now, responses sometimes happen, but in most cases, it does not. So again, class completion certificates, along with promoting their effort of trying and succeeding on our website, may be an option that we should consider. Involving our operation with the social media, such as Facebook, has been suggested. And frankly, at the moment, this idea seems to have as many pros as it does cons, so there'll be more to follow, I'm sure, on this one. Gary and I have been discussing it quite deeply in just the last day or so. Nickel time. So, guys and gals, that's it in a brief overview for an ongoing project. Let's see at the moment if we have any comments or questions from either our staff or audience, and then I'll turn it back to the maestro. The pillar and microphone is open. Anybody like to say anything?
KC2GA and a quick comment.
Why, Maestro, you have the floor again. Over.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to pass along that Gordon and I did have some very good conversations regarding the use of social media, and particularly Facebook. And although we don't have a real framework or a plan in place right now, I think that ultimately we have an awful lot of potential for expansion outside of the immediate group right now, and a great amount of potential for interaction within the group. So I think on both regards. If we do become more active in social media, there's a lot of benefits for everybody concerned. It's an exciting time. So stand by for news because some good things are going to be happening one way or the other. Back to KY6V.
Hey, thanks for that. While you're up and running here, I believe you'd like to comment or possibly can comment on some of the input that you've got from our other staff members and so on.
Indeed. As a matter of fact, we have heard from our international membership. SLAB, as you may be familiar with SLAB, UA3QGN, has prepared these observations about our hobby. Now, SLAB, and SLAB's, you know, got a great radio mind. I will tell you this right now. SLAB says that our hobby is important for and needs to be a resource to, one, learn foreign languages. And yeah, you know, when you think about it, amateur radio is a great way to learn a foreign language. Two, promote friendship between countries. And I know, and I'm sure everybody's had pretty much some degree of experience with that. You know, you get on 17 meters or 20 meters, and the next thing you know, you're talking to some guy from you know, who knows where, but someplace that you know, you're not quite sure you've ever talked to before. You know, you're talking to all kinds of people around the world, and you start to realize that, you know, everybody's the same. You know, we speak different languages, we live in different places, but, you know, when you're sitting there on your side of the microphone and he's on, or she is on the her side, their side of the microphone, works out, everybody's the same. Number three, help to know more about customs and traditions of other countries and places, and that kind of goes to what we were just talking about. Number four, promote traveling by visiting ham friends, domestic and international. And yeah, I've done that, and I'm sure others have done that as well, to actually go and visit somebody that you know as a voice on the radio. Let me buy a nickel. Number five, to learn about love. The amore. Yeah. Not all people know how to do it, I'm afraid, but those that do are either giglios or they're, you know, or real romantics, you know, but Slav says that amateur radio is a great way to learn about love. Number three, and by the way, giglio was just being funny. Number six, learn how to do less thinking about politics, more thinking about things which unite us all. And I will admit that I am a very political person, and sometimes it is good to take a little holiday from that. And finally, number seven, promote our command and rising interest for kids about our technologies and our ham radio hobby. Because it is, you know something, ham radio is just a great way to bond with any kid that's got, you know, a little technological spark in them. I think the natural curiosity of a kid, you know, when he or she can see what this hobby is really capable of, it's just a wonderful gift to give to a youngster, and you know, can start on a lifetime of technological interest. So it's pretty cool. So Slav had some nice points there, and we thank him for that. And we go on now to look for some more check-ins as this TIN continues. Any comments? Anybody wanting to say hello or anything else? Just come on in right now as we take check-ins on the TIN. I'm KC2GA, and this is South Cars.
This is Whiskey November 4 Victor checking in. I also have a comment for Gordon about certificates.
Echo Whiskey Golf.
All right, we had a couple that time. We'll kick it off with November 4 Victor. Come on aboard.
KC2WA, or GA, excuse me, WN4V in Bradenton, Florida. I know Gordon knows where that, or my location is, and we're doing quite well today. It's 62 degrees right now, and it'll get down in the 40s tonight, low 40s. That said, I have a comment regarding certificates for Gordon. Just a suggestion that a certificate could be designed and placed on the website and as a PDF file and downloaded by members that way, and it would certainly be a less expensive way than printing things up, since you could print it yourself from with your own printer. It's just a suggestion. Back to you, Gary. KC2GA, WN4V.
Thank you, sir. KY6V, any comment?
Yeah, hi there, Mr. Bradenton. Hey, I know where you're hiding. KY6V here. Thanks for that, John. Well, I'll tell you what, we're really doing that in a fashion already. Although we're not utilizing the website per se. We've got some certificates that are already made up and into our data files. We do send certificates to our new NCSs and our board of directors people and things like that. And we handle it all via email, John. We fill the certificate out with the appropriate call sign and effective dates and, you know, that kind of stuff. And then we ship it off to the person that's going to receive it. And their task, once they have it, is to print it out. We send it in two forms, PDF and Word. So if they don't have one, they've got another choice. They print it out, and we recommend that it's printed on a photo paper type stock to give you the glossy things. Any comments on that, John? And then I'll send it back to Gary.
That's what I really meant, Gordon, to have the certificate filled out at your end and then emailed to the recipient. I don't think I really phrased it correctly the first time. Just to place a certificate on the website would be, I guess, counterproductive. But the method you suggested, I like that one very much. Other than that, I really don't have any other comments. WN4V.
You're okay. Is that J-O-N short for Jonathan? If so, my youngest son is called Jonathan. John, over.
No, that's the way it is. No Jonathan, just John. My mother decided to be different and leave out the H.
Oh, well, I think that was a brilliant idea. Thank you, sir. Back to you, Gary, KY6V.
Thank you, Gordon, and thank you, John. And we move along now to David. Echo, Whiskey George, welcome to the net, sir.
Well, good evening to you, Gary, and everybody else on the net. David, KV9EWG, La Crosse, Wisconsin. Currently 40 degrees and sunny out here, so just checking in, saying good evening, and so far everything's sounding real good on this end here as far as the plans and everything. Back on TIN, so looking forward to hearing more from KV9EWG.
Well, thank you, sir. Well, I do believe you'll be treated to a potpourri of interesting information tonight. We've got, we really do have some good stuff coming down the line. As a matter of fact, we're going to call on W4RFJ for a couple of things. I think he has some information about the new ham bands. Have you heard about this? If you have not, we will see what information can be gleaned from that. And I think we also have some information coming up for new technician band privileges, which is great news for you guys just getting your license, because there may be some good things in the wind for you. So let's get the story behind the story. W4RFJ, what's happening?
Gary 6 Victor, I don't see him in there. if I may, I'll go ahead and handle that for him. I'm a little worried. He's a very Johnny-on-the-spot guy, so something's happening up there in Ridley Park, Pennsylvania, over.
Yeah, you're right. I don't see him on the list. You know, so perhaps alien abduction? I don't know. I hope everything is all right, though. But if you'd be kind enough to take that segment, we'd certainly appreciate it. So KY6V, come on aboard.
Okay, and maybe if he doesn't show, George and I will be about back and forth. Maybe you can take the next one, George, as a suggestion. All right, technician band privileges and so on. What Roger was going to say is that a major ham radio advisory organization has filed a petition. So it's just a petition at this point. With the FCC to expand the privileges of technician class licenses. And the new privileges would include and provide digital mode privileges and RTTY on 80, 40, 15, and 10 meters with limited phone privileges on 75, 40, and 15. Now, that's quite a wrinkle. Improvements in the STEM, S-T-E-M, education and student interests are cited as a major reason for this expansion of operating privileges. Now numbering 378,000. Let me buy a nickel. That's the number of licensed technicians here in the United States, and I think we've got a total of somewhere over 700,000 total. So, you know, big bite. 378,000 technician licenses comprise more than half of the U.S. amateur radio population, according to the ARRL. So making participation in the hobby easier and attractive to young people who may future leaders, you know, in science and technology and engineering and math and you name it, are given as major advantages for the change. The large number of technician class licenses is consistent with the South Car's statistical summary that I mentioned, a little bit ago. Now, I will say that opponents to the expanded technician class license operating privileges, I'm looking up to make sure I'm not timing out, are concerned about lowered motivation to progress to the higher license classes requiring a broader range of electronics and operational knowledge. Well, you know, some truth to that. let me buy a nickel. So our conference strives to maintain, this is the same people talking, members strive to training and proficiency of any class license and experience record as capable radio and emergency communicators. The advisory organization petition also coincides, with this year's release of the new technician class exam. I've downloaded that. We're having our technician class starting up here on the 12th of July. I have not read it through word for word or verbatim, so I don't know what these guys are saying there, but we'll find out. Once again, South Cars will offer this technician class. As I just mentioned, it starts on the 12th of July and run about 4 weeks. We do that on purpose because we know that the new license becomes effective on July the 1st. Each of these license classes change their Q&A every 4 years, and they're staggered. So next year, the general class will change, and following year, the extra will change, so on and so forth. So, Gary, back to you. I'll let you pick up any comments, sir. KY6V, over.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to throw my two cents worth in, just right up front, and maybe we can get some people talking about that too. Personally, I think it's a great idea. And let me explain to you why, okay, because I think, you know, I'm starting to see comments in the box here, so much for incentive licensing and all that. They're talking about a portion of the bands, and they're talking about the digital portion of the bands and some limited voice. Let's take a look at where the licensing requirements came from, that history. Back when we were establishing licensing requirements, you had to have a lot more technical savvy than you do now. Let's be honest. You know, people were building their own equipment. People were designing their own equipment. It was a much more hands-on hobby than it is now. It's not to say that it is not now a hands-on hobby. It's not the hobby today doesn't require any technical expertise. It does, but it's a different form. We are moving towards a digital age. We are in a digital age. We are experiencing a high degree of growth in the digital portion of our hobby. Let me buy a nickel. It's a different technology. It's a different way of addressing technology. And again, we're not building transmitters. We're not building radios anymore. We're buying them from China. We're buying them from, you know, from Japan, you know. So we're not doing that anymore. What we rely mostly on is digital competence and antenna theory. We still need to know the basics, but we also have to have licensing reflect the technology that we're using. I think that's real world stuff, you know. Also, I mean, you think about it. You ask where's the incentive. Let me just buy a nickel. Think about where you were when you went from technician to general and what you were using and how your view of radio, of amateur radio was then. You probably had a little handheld 2-meter rig, or maybe if you're lucky, a 2440 or something like that. That was your world, you know. You got that general ticket, and all of a sudden, the world is your world. It's a whole different ball game. And the way that you approach the hobby, once you have that open to you, is quite different from when you've got that little handheld, you know. When your objective is to put a good signal into the repeater versus working all the way around the world. Whole different way of looking at things. So it makes sense, at least in that regard, to give new operators a taste of what they can get once they upgrade. So the incentive, I think, is still there. It's just different. So if you put on a different pair of glasses and look at it, that's what I think they're talking about. Anyway, we'll open it up for comments right now. What do you think about that? As we continue the TIN, I'm KC2GA, and this is South Coast. And the silence, as they say, was deafening. Anybody want to comment on that? Well, okay. Let's move on then, okay? We were talking about the new technician privileges. We were talking about, or we were talking at least mentioning the fact that our radio service received a new frequency band in October 2017. So, if you don't know about it, you're gonna. Let's move along to NO70, who has some information on that. George, come on aboard.
Well, thank you, Gary. Although I see from the text box that maybe Chief W4FJ might have tried to get a word in. Is that true, Chief W4FJ, NO70? First, and then I'll go with the next headline, over.
I'm so sorry, guys. I am here. I'm trying to figure out where I need to be on the script, and I'll just follow along. Just yell at me when you need me. W4RFJ.
Thank you, Chief. We're on the bottom of page 6, and you're coming up in about 2 minutes. So, well, this is South Card, the TIN. Thank you to everyone here tonight. Thank all the moderators, and thank each of you that are checking in and for your comments and check-ins tonight. The next topic tonight is our amateur radio service received a new frequency band in October 2017. Our radio service has been given new operating privileges on the frequencies of 135.7 to 135.8 kilohertz and 472.0 to 479.0 kilohertz. Now, mobile operation is not permitted in these bands. However, before using either band, stations must notify the Utilities Technology Council of the station's planned operation, of your station's planned operation, too. If the Technology Council does not respond to your notification of operation within 30 days, you may begin operation in those bands. Let me reset. Now, once you have registered your intent to operate with the UTC, you may operate until the UTC files a complaint that your station did not fit the criteria for operation. If you don't hear anything from them, you are authorized to operate. The registration process defends our stations from the interference claim that the utilities companies that use a line current method of transmission on our radio frequencies, and by our registration and letting them know that we will be active as a radio service, it improves our radio service's future claims to operate on those same frequencies when you may be located close by. So, we'd like to ask you to please help us protect our operating privileges as a radio service by registering to operate on this band, even if your operation may not be in the immediate future. If you think you might be interested in 5-10 years from now, or hams in your household might be interested, time to register. If you're within 1 kilometer of a power line, then there may be an impediment to your being authorized or approved to operate in the band. But hopefully the band will be available to all of us in the future as a larger number of our operators register for these special utilities bands. Are there any comments or new check-ins or rechecks? Please call back to Gary for that. This is now 7-0 and listening now.
Thank you, sir. I just want to shoot a quick comment in there, and again, we'll throw it out for anybody else to comment on too. But I would love to be operating, you know, in that 472 to 479 K band. But honestly, I mean, who has the space for an antenna for something like that? A lot of us, you know, live in cities. You know, I'm here on a city lot. The only reason I can work 40 is using a loop. You know, so you really do have to have some real estate for that. It would just be wonderful, you know, to get on that band, but I don't see it as really being terrifically practical anyway. Anywho, that's my 2 cents worth. Anybody else have any comments? Let's take some check-ins as we continue on the TIN.
6 Victor.
We have 6 Victor. Anybody else?
7-0.
XCX.
That's a nice little collection, so let's kick it off with 6 Victor. Go right ahead, sir.
Hey, muchas gracias, Gary. Well, boy, this is just perfect because my question is for George on his last statements, and he's next in line. So I'm just going to ask, point out my misunderstanding possibly, and let him clarify it when he takes it up on his section. George, it's my understanding that the comment about being within a kilometer of a power source is more of an alert to the operator that they may be subject to more interference because of that close proximity. Not that it necessarily impeded any approval of the registration, but I may be misinterpreting that, George. Up to you, sir, from KY6V, over.
KY6V and the South Guard's TIN, NO70. Well, actually, it is an impediment. So the UTC can deny registration if the station's location is within 1 kilometer of the power line. That was part of the arrangement made between the FCC and the UTC. Now, again, mobile operation is not permitted, so you are talking about a fixed station operation. However, also in regard to the feasibility of operation antennas and so forth, well, you never know when you may move, you may find you have antenna space. There is no requirement to actually operate once you register. If we do register, then we put a reservation in a sense of the presence of our amateur radio service on those bands, and the more ham radio stations that are registered, the more our operating privileges are protected in the long run. Even if you don't transmit, you know, in the next year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, at least we have let them know, yes, we're here, yes, we do public service, yes, we do maintain an interest in those frequencies. So registration is advised to protect our service, even if the antenna or operation may be in the future. All right, did I answer the questions? And I'll turn it back to Gary. I think we had another station waiting, KCQGA and NO70.
Yeah, well, I'll grab that pause. May I have another quickie with George? Gary, over.
You may have as much as you want, sir. And I also had George as next on that list of check-ins. I don't know if what he's doing right now had anything to do with that. So go right ahead. And George, if you had something else you wanted to bring up, go right ahead, too.
No, I think I threw a curveball in there by turning it directly to George. But at any rate, George, we don't have to debate this now, but, you know, being sometimes a Philadelphia lawyer, I'm a little concerned about what I'm hearing. If you can be rejected from use of these bands because you're within a kilometer of a, what's that turn out for us, 6/10 of a mile, in English, what does that mean? You know, all of us, particularly in residential housing, are well within that kilometer when we're talking about our power lines, and I'm talking about the power that's fed to your house. You may have a transformer a couple of houses away that's dropping down from a 7kV line or something. Are they talking the high babies, you know, the 40 kilowatts, 40,000 volts and up? Are they talking the 7K lines? Are they talking your 120-volt feed? I mean, this might close it down for everybody, George. KY6V, over.
Well, Gordon, that's a very good observation, and that is part of the conflict. That's where this is a first time that I'm aware of where FCC has delegated part of their regulatory or approval processes to an industry group. Pretty much the point that was made by one of our ham radio advocacy groups was let them make the decision. If you go ahead and apply for the operating privileges, they may turn you down, but at least the application provides an indication of our presence. And if they the other thing is, if they don't get back to you within 30 days, even if you're within that limit, you have the privileges, and they are supposedly not able to repeal it if they fail to advise you within 30 days. So who knows? You might get it even with, well, I won't go that far to say that, but the handwriting might be on the wall. Hope I answered the question. KY6VNO70.
All I can say is this is going to be fun. Thank you, George. Go ahead.
And I did make the point about the need to register. That was my point earlier, that even you don't have to actually be operating immediately. You can, as long as you have in your mind a planned operation, time to register. So back to you, Gary, to pick up. I think there was another person, KC2GA-NO70, over.
Correct you are, sir, and thank you, first of all. And we move it along now to X-Ray Charlie X-Ray. Welcome once again to the net.
Well, thank you, Gary. I think I've got some of my question answered here. It's a very foolish question, but at first I misunderstood it. I didn't hear the word kilohertz versus megahertz. That makes a lot of difference. Now, if there's kilohertz, there's no way that my wife is going to let me put up a tower that tall. Okay. To do something like that. I don't know. Maybe I can put a loop around my garage and load that. Who knows? But anyway, that's interesting. And yeah, I see how NO has that, should help us out there. Hang on just a second. Or, we could help. Let me reset just a minute. Well, it does seem to me like NO70 has a point there, that we ought to at least let them know that we're active hams and we would like to have those bands, And who knows? Maybe they'll, maybe they'll lighten up in the future if they know that there are actually some people out there that would be interested in doing that. But where do we send them? How do we get a hold of the UTC? And is it county or state? Will there be something on your website that will show that? N5XCX, back to net. Over.
Well, all I can say is I can certainly sympathize with the with the XY Owl putting the mix on the tower. I can tell you that. And it's, it's intriguing. It's, I know the whereabouts of an old Collins AM broadcast transmitter that could probably be nicely retuned to those bands. Honestly, it does not seem practical for a lot of purposes. Now, having said that, you're absolutely right, it's not going to hurt a thing to put in a reservation to use the frequencies. Who knows what's going to happen 5 years down the line. So all you're doing is saying, I want to get in on this, and that's, a minimal amount of effort, I would think. Now, does anybody have any information how you can go about applying for this permission? We'll throw that open right now.
70.
Go right ahead, sir.
If you'll check our website under the news section over the right-hand side, click on more and look down through all the headlines, you will see one of the headlines about the this new operation. You can open that article up, and in the article is the URL, and it gives you the full information of what we're talking about. So that would be the best place to go at this time. It looks like that the link may change a little bit, or you may need to try the link twice. Back to you, Gary, on 70.
Sounds like a plan to me. Thank you, sir. As we move along on our potpourri of all kinds of good stuff tonight on the TIN, there are new malware and viruses and crypto-locking variants, cropping up all over the place. If that doesn't scare you, it will shortly. Let's check in with the late W4RFJ and see if he can give us the story on what's happening.
KC2GA with the South Cars TIN. This is W4RFJ. You hearing me okay, Gary?
I am, sir. We have you loud and clear.
All righty then. Gary started talking about malware and viruses and crypto-locking variants, there are two forms of malware that have emerged, file-based and file-less. Viruses, trojans, crypto-locking software, and other malware can take one of our stations offline without warning and at the worst times. Efforts at recovery are expensive in money and time and can endanger the public welfare and safety if the infection occurs during emergency operations. I'd like to interject some information that I read today. At work, we have a security, an IT security guy, and he sent out a bunch of traffic about artificial intelligence. Some of these files or some of these viruses, trojans, and crypto-locking software/malware can take on an artificial intelligence. Anybody who's a fan of person of interest can understand that that can even cause emergency situations. Anyway, file-based malware works by changing a file on the system and attempting to hide its presence by changing file metadata and headers in the physical file itself. That instructs the computer how to work. Let me grab a nickel. Okay, I grabbed my nickel. Now I'm trying to grab the next page. It's giving me a hard time. Give me just a second. Anyway, traditional antivirus detection methods may not detect all fileless malware, which have emerged as greater risk because the identifying marks are hidden in the memory after the infection. Simply by visiting an infected website without downloading or clicking on any web page can lead to an infection inserting itself into the targeted computer's memory and be unknown to the visitor using their own computer. A state-sponsored malware infection attack against a specific brand of router has also recently been reported. That router is used by government and defense offices as well as consumers. Let me grab another nickel. Is this all coming through okay, Gary?
Coming through just fine, Roger. Perhaps you might let us know, if it's possible, what that router is. People may be using that.
Well, the only thing is I don't have that information directly available here, but we can find out and get back to everybody if that's okay.
Definitely. That'd be fine, because the other question I had while I've got you, can you rid yourself of any problems? Let's say that you do visit an infected site and it gets into the browser cache. If you clear the cache every time you turn the computer off, will that keep you safe?
Well, my answer to that is not necessarily. Keeping your cache clean is a good way to start getting rid of it, but a good virus checking software that monitors your email and your websites would be a better bet. I think I answered that question.
Indeed you did. Thank you.
Well, this next paragraph I have here kind of talks about that too. There is still a large measure of protection from malware of all forms by antivirus and firewalling software. Especially paid services have greater resources to target and defeat the paths of infection. We must be able to troubleshoot our radio and computer equipment for all forms of this new breed of malware. Let me grab a nickel. Especially given its potential for disrupting emergency and support communications at the moment of need for station emergency operations. Now, I know I'm going to talk more about staying away from websites, but you got to think about this for a minute, everybody. The best protection from and the best security you can get from the Internet is not to connect to it. By staying away from websites with a certificate warning, that's using an encryption service like VPNs or key authenticity checks, using ad blockers that will prevent the I got my tongue tied around my eye tooth, couldn't see what I was saying. Malevolent sites from arriving at your computer's browser, using the built-in protection of your router and watching for signs of unusual behavior. Frequent and unexpected reboots, reading up on daily security bulletins, and having backups and third-generation backups of your important files or correspondence and expensive software along with an operating system recovery disk, you should be able to prevent or recover with less time and expense from malware risks. I actually have a friend of mine that has his doctorate in IT, and that's his idea of the best security you can get. Just don't connect to the Internet. Let's see. I guess I'll pass it over to Gary to check for some more check-ins or questions or comments or rechecks. I'm just glad and happy to be here. W4RFJ. Late, Chief. Go ahead, Gary.
And we're glad and happy to have you. It is a scary world out there, isn't it? And it just never seems to get any better. Every couple of months, we're going through something else. So it just doesn't get any better. But you know, you can minimize the risks. And I guess you know, if you want to play the game, you have to accept the challenge too. But thank you, Roger. We are looking for some check-ins right now. Does anybody have any comments or rechecks or, a good joke would be fine, too. Anybody wants to check in, we'd love to have you. Taking check-ins right now on the TIN. I'm KC2GA, and this is South Cars. Nope. Okay. I guess everybody's in the mood to listen tonight, so that's fine. All right. Here's an interesting topic, and I, for one, would like to hear more about it. The question is, the topic, rather, is that it is now possible to run Linux in Windows 10. Now, I know how to do that in one fashion, but I'm wondering if that's the same thing that I'm thinking of. Let's check in with NO70 and see what he's got.
KC2GA and the South Cars TIN, NO70. This actually is different than running Linux in a virtual machine. You can actually run Linux without a virtual machine if you have the most recent Windows Fall Creators Update. Windows has recognized the increased interest in Linux-type operating systems. Some say that there is a reduced risk of activities for malware and viruses in Linux. Some say not, but some say there are. The Windows Linux Bash shell is in Microsoft's Fall Creators Update, and it will allow you to run programs in a Linux environment using serial device support like SSHD, TMUX, and remote connection support like OpenSSH, VPN, PowerShell Remoting, and others. You even can have multiple Linux distributions active on your Windows machine, all active at the same time, no, three or four different distributions, so that you can compare the distributions and see which one you like and that you might want to prefer to use as your most active one. Possible distributions would include Ubuntu, OpenSUSE, and Use Linux Enterprise Server 12. Now, Gary, I'm going to turn it back for you for more information about how to check whether your computer does have access to these Linux shells outside of the virtual machines. KC2GA, NO70, over.
Well, that is fascinating. Now, you have to have the developer's version of Windows 10. Is that correct, George?
The information I have is just the creators, Fall Creators Update, the most recent one. They've moved it out of the development into mainstream now, is the information I have, Gary. KC2GA, NO70.
Well, I'm going to have to nose around for that because, I was thinking of, you know, a virtual machine. That little laptop of mine would be great to fool around with this. So that's pretty cool. Now, I have some information here. Okay, and thank you, George, for some. I have some information here about how to check your computer for access to the Linux shells, okay? Now, this is, again, if you have, this was an upgrade that you can do to your Windows 10 called the Creator's Update, okay? If you have upgraded to the Creator's Update, you should have access to the Windows Linux shell. And we buy a nickel, and I'll tell you how to do it. To see if your Windows system has been upgraded and can run the Linux shells, you may use the Windows Command Shell and the WSL config /L command, okay? And again, if you're not taking notes, you can certainly find this on the internet. If the command shows no Linux activated, activate it using the control panel, turn Windows features on or off, and place a check mark next to the Windows subsystem for Linux. Okay. Again, this would probably be a lot easier if you have a printout with the steps. But we'll give you the lowdown here, and if it sounds good to you, you can go out and get the step-by-step. You're going to have to reboot, and once you reboot, set your default Linux distribution in a command shell window, and there's going to be a group of commands, which I will not give you now, so it'll mean no sense to you, but you would type in the configuration for the distribution, and that will get you started. Now, just be careful that you avoid stepping on the Linux C shells. We don't want you to suffer where you put your Linux foot down while walking on the Linux shoreline. Okay, C shells, yeah, C. Okay, let me buy a nickel. All right, bottom line on that whole thing is, with this upgrade to Windows 10, you do not have to set up a dual boot system. Unless you want to, but I mean, you can actually run Linux within Windows, and I think that's some pretty cool stuff. All right, having gotten it out of the way, are there any check-ins at this point? Would anybody like to comment or recheck at this time?
7-0 comment.
7-0, go right ahead.
One may need to actually activate that in your Windows control panel settings if necessary, but it should be out there. And if a person's updates are up to speed with Microsoft's releases, you probably have the capability out there. May need to run the shells as administrator, but it should be out there for everyone. And you may have to activate it in command settings once you verify it's present. Should be there, though. Thanks, Gary. KC2GA, NO7O.
Thanks, George. You know, I'm going to try that. my laptop, I'm talking to you now on an iMac, but I have a Windows 10 laptop that, I do all the updates on. So I probably have that, and I'd like to see what I can do with it. That just sounds like a ton of fun, and we will be fooling around with that later on tonight. Thanks again. Hey, we were talking about Wi-Fi security. WPA2 recently discovered there's a weakness, and W4RFJ has some information on that. What's going on with that? I thought that was good and secure.
No, it used to be, but most of the stuff that I'm talking about can be found on the reference. Should I read the reference, George?
I can put it in the text box. She said before, Jay, this is NO7O.
Thank you. That would be perfect. The discovery was announced in August of 2017 of the WPA2 Wi-Fi security compromise. a weakness of the WPA2 protocol was found using a key reinstallation attack, abbreviated KRACK. The WPA2 key could be cloned and reinstalled with a key that could be used by the outsider. Anyone exploiting the vulnerability could log into a WPA2 connection without even using a password. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security confirmed the vulnerability to the general public. At present, some intermediate measures have been identified that reduce the vulnerability and have been included in updates, including the Windows, Raspberry Pi, Wi-Fi environments. However, we must wait for a new standard to be developed and implement. Perhaps ham operators will be the ones to do so, just as they did with AX25. You know, something I want to add to this, and I apologize for not saying anything sooner, but there is a way to maintain a higher level of Wi-Fi security, and that's using a capture, or what do they call it? It just left my head. I have been successfully programmed a Raspberry Pi 3 to act as a captive portal and thus using a RADIUS server to authenticate a person's usage of that system. And it is very much better than WPA2. However, it takes a little bit of thinking effort to get it working. But anyway, Gary, I guess I'll pass it back over to you and call for more comments, check-ins, or rechecks, because my voice is starting to go.
Yes, I understand how that feels. And indeed, that's what we are going to do. Anybody have any comments, any rechecks, anything at all to say at this time? Come on aboard. Well, it's a quiet night out there, but we'll keep moving on to one of the favorite topics among all hams. It doesn't matter what group of hams you're talking to. You mentioned the word antenna, and folks are going to be talking, and everybody has problems, everybody has opinions, everybody has their favorites. So I don't think there's a person on this planet that knows more about antennas than this guy. We're turning it over to KY6V. Gordon, enlighten us.
Nah, I don't know if I fill those shoes at all. But I have forgotten a lot about antennas, too. Thanks, Gary. KY6V here. Well, I want to just throw a little bit of thinking into a common problem they all run into, okay? And so my tip this evening is to suggest an easy way to hang an antenna in a tree of any size. And I learned this over 65 years or plus of hamming experience. Since wire antennas are in popular use, the two considerations are where to hang the bloomin' thing and, you know, how high can I hang it? And these methods range from, you know, throwing a rock with a string tied on the rock to using a slingshot, using a fly casting rod and a reel and others. Let me buy a nickel. So I'll tell you a story. One day about 26 years ago, I happened to find myself shopping in town. And while wandering around the store, I came across an aisle displaying bow and arrows. And within this display were a kid's starter set. It consisted of a small, maybe 2.5 foot bow and 3 arrows. And as I recall, the whole kit and caboodle was all of about $11.95. Well, from there, it was fast and easy. So let me try to explain this. The fishing line from a fly casting rod and reel was fastened to the back of an arrow. And my wife held the fishing rod behind me, and I would point and send the arrow flying at the point of the tree that I wanted the antenna to be at. I would then retrieve the arrow where it landed, remove the arrow from the fishing line, and replace it with the end of a ball of string. Give it a little more weight, a little more toughness, okay? The fishing line was then pulled back into the realm of the fishing pole until the string reached the pole. The opposite end of the string was cut, and a regular guy wire attached to the string. By pulling the string back towards the fishing pole, we had a guy wire spanning the tree, fastened to the antenna, and pulled tight and anchored. I'll tell you what, guys, I've been doing this now for years. It's just a beautiful, easy way to do it. So, you know, when you're through, the important step was to open up a cold beer of your favorite beer manufacturer and, yeah, celebrate the whole blooming thing. Let me buy a nickel. Fred, K2HA, was supposed to ride with me in this segment on antennas, and he found that he was going to be occupied on some church activity here this evening, and so I said that I would just pick up his input. So if I may, I will sort of parley what he wanted to leave with you. He reported that low-loss feeding, and we're talking antennas, low-loss feeding, low SWR, and a great radiation pattern can be replaced the need for an amplifier. And, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. In areas that limit antenna use, a good stealth antenna can get you on the air. Very low-loss feed line, important. Good waterproof connections, even more important. And a properly tuned antenna will work fine even if the wire is just tacked under the eaves of the house. Waterproof all connections, use stainless steel screws with dissimilar metals, and sit back and have some fun. So those are comments from K2HA. Gary, I'll pass it back to you and let you pick up any check-ins at this point. KY6V, over.
Well, thank you, sir. I got to tell you, those are all very good. I love your antenna locating, or your, you know, the bow and arrow thing. That's great stuff. That really is. I'll tell you one of the things the guy did here locally. I've got a friend who is a pretty accomplished drone flyer. And he used a drone to put a wire antenna up, and it was great. He said it's awesome. It worked beautifully. I guess you'd have to have, number one, the expertise to supply the thing, and number two, the right situation, you know, a good clear tree and all that. But he got it up pretty quick using the drone. So going back to high tech, you know, there's two different ways of doing it, low tech and high tech. They both work out pretty well. And also, let me just buy a nickel. I think Fred has some great points about, you know, keeping things, if you're keeping things as efficient and problem-proof as possible, you certainly may not need an amplifier. What are you using for feed lines? You know, if you're not using LMR or something like that, you know, even RG8U is great. You know, you look at the loss figures on that. But, you know, going back to the basics, you know, use something with the lowest loss per 100. Look at the highest operating frequency that you're going to use and figure it from that, and use the shortest length possible, because remember, loss is dependent on length. So, you know, if you're losing a dB per 100 feet and I need a 50, run 50, because you're only going to lose half a dB, right? You know, so stuff like that. just make sure that you're operating in the most efficient manner that you can, and you'd be surprised what a difference that really does make. Okay, thank you, Gordon. And let's see if anybody wants to check in at this time. This is the TIN. I'm KC2GA, and this is South Coast. Well, nothing heard. So let's head on towards the coffee break. After the coffee break, we'll continue at a look with cell phones. That's 4G, 5G, Echolink, and digital communications technology. The changes in all those, among others. Now, we think it would be a valuable use of your time to stay with us after the coffee break. It is now time for that. While you refill your coffee cups, we're going to share an April Fool's prank with you. I'm always interested in those. N070, what's going on there?
Well, thank you, Gary. And N070, once again, good evening to everyone on the South Coast TIN. Glad you're here with us. And while you do go get your coffee cup refill, this is the last TIN before April 1st, so we're going to play an April Fool's prank joke on you. Now, caution, do not use this procedure of how to clean the inside walls of your rig's semiconductors, integrated chips, and transistors. You know, they get really gunked up with all of those rag-chew electrons, like we said earlier and everything. But so we're going to tell you how to clean off the inside walls of your semiconductors. Now, caution, do not use this procedure. It's a joke. If you choose to do so, it's at your own risk, and South Cars and I cannot be responsible for any damage that you cause to the equipment as a result of using this avant-garde cleaning technique, courtesy of our chief engineer, who you well know by a four-letter call. Okay, well, anyway. So while you head to the kitchen to refill your coffee or tea mug, here are the proper steps to clean the inside of your transistors and ICs. You may want to listen carefully. Resetting. Now, it takes 5 items to run the cleaning program. All 5 are required. First, you will need a holding reservoir to contain the dirt accumulated inside your transistors and ICs. And that reservoir has to be connected to the output pin of the device you're cleaning. This reservoir acts as the load for the device's output. The second thing you want to need are 2 volt ohm or multimeters, one reading the current between the device output and the reservoir, and the other reading the voltage being delivered to the input of the device from the generator. So you need a current on the output and a voltage measurement on the input device. The third thing you're going to need, of course, is the device that you're going to be cleaning. And then let me reset. You also will need a signal generator capable of producing a sawtooth wave at the level required. All right, now this procedure I'm about to describe to you allows your transistors or ICs to be internally cleaned by inserting a sawtooth signal into the device's input circuit at a level 10% higher than the maximum specifications of the device. The sawtooth wave, being high in harmonics and phase, of course, in its travel, cleans the inside wall of the device's tunnels. Once you start this procedure, the current from the output must be watched, and when the current of the output reaches 10% higher than the maximum specification before failure than when it first started, then you know that the device has reached its clean level. And that is how you clean the inside of your rig's electronics, where all of your rag chews and conversations and QSOs and listening and shortwave listening, all that stuff just gets crammed up in the corners up in there and needs a good cleaning. That's how you get it cleaned out. Back to you, Gary. Casey, thanks to, again, the engineer of the conference for that. Back to you, Gary. KC2GA, N070 on the TIN.
You would be amazed at how much crud accumulates, too. So give it a good cleaning, and honestly, you'll be a much happier operators, getting rid of all that. Just amazing. Thank you. Thank you very much, George, for that message on hygiene. It's very good. Hey, that's the end of the coffee break, get back to work. While you're putting your coffee cups away, anybody have any check-ins that they'd like to do right now? Okay, once again, mucho silencio. Okay, we were moving along. We were talking, or we had said that we were going to get to the topic of cell phone communications, echoing, and computer-based radio communications. Okay, this is my turn. for a little bit. The House of Representatives was scheduled to vote on Tuesday, March 6, 2018, on a bill that works to advance 5G networks and to identify more spectrum for private sector use. Now, the bill includes provision to reduce the red tape and industry associated with building wireless networks. 10 5G network security attacks have been detailed by researchers at Purdue University, and the University of Iowa, who exposed weaknesses in the cellular network. The ability of the networks to securely attach a device to the network, to maintain a connection, and to receive calls and messages are affected. Although authentication relay attacks aren't new, this latest research shows that they can be used to intercept messages, track a user's location, and stop a phone from connecting to the network. It's not nice stuff. NO70 has some more information about the capacity of 5G networks.
Well, yes, Gary, a 5G network provides up to 1 million connections per square kilometer. This will bring an exponential increase in the number of connections available for cell phone, voice, and digital users. The latency on a 4G network, 50 milliseconds, is half that of a 3G network. the throughput of a 4G network is 10 times higher than that of a 3G network, but the popularity of 4K circuit streams signals has placed a demand on the 4G networks that can no longer meet the new information throughput that consumers desire. You know, we have the 4K, the ultra high definition, and all of that. So, and people do enjoy streaming a lot of things to their cell phones. This has placed consumer demand for faster networks and has provided a lot of incentive for 5G. Case, so that's pretty much it. I'll let you call for check-ins or rechecks, and then I'll continue on, Gary. KC2GA, NO70.
Kind of sounds like we should open up a giant-sized can of bandwidth, and everything would be all right. Okay, this is an opportunity for anyone who wants to check in to check in. So let's do it right now if you care to. I'm KC2GA, and this is South Cars looking for check-ins. Nothing heard, so we move it along, and we'll go right back to NO70. I believe we're going to talk a little bit about the Internet of Things, Echolink operation, and good stuff like that. So both fascinating topics. George, what do you have for us?
All right, KCTGA and the South Coast CIN, NO70. Well, the Internet of Things, which is capital I, lowercase O, and uppercase T, and that is a different abbreviation than capital I, capital O, capital T. There is a difference. So I'm talking about Internet of Things, which we're seeing happen all the time in our homes. We've got lights controlled, refrigerator, inventory monitored, Echolink running, your TV and radio. Perhaps you have Hue lights in. Perhaps you have lights behind your TV to relieve visual strain. You have electronic doorbells. You know, all these things take up addresses, take up a spot on the Internet. for us ham radio operators, Echolink is one of our Internet of Things. It's one that only we can use as ham operators. I think it's an important part of this shack's operation, and I have a feeling that that would be true of anyone logged into the TIN tonight. With the increasing number of radios using computer-based controls on your ham shack's network, radio operation today also requires a good knowledge of computer network connections. Now, we have lost many operators in our amateur radio service because they could not make their new or preferred equipment work, or because they became frustrated with problems with their new equipment for lack of information on how to solve them. We would have the benefit of these stations' continued operation and presence in our amateur radio service if they had been able to take a moment to understand the problems they were facing and the solutions, and especially how to keep two pieces of equipment from interfering with each other's operation on the Radio Shack's Ethernet network. An example of this is an Echolink, where stations have unsuccessfully and frustratingly tried to use Echolink for contacts using two pieces of Echolink-based equipment at the same time using the same internal Ethernet network. Now, for more on this, we're going to turn to our resident engineer, KY6V. KY6V, NO70, please, over.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Thanks, George. KY6V here. Well, I'm going to ad-lib this segment, if you don't mind. And it's a segment that I'll be giving a brief explanation on why the IP addresses used is important to be a statically assigned set of numbers, and so on and so forth. So I'm going to throw out a hypothetical question, let you think about it and get your mind moving, and then I'm going to give a brief explanation as to how I view that question. The first one would be, what is NAT, November Alpha Tango, and what can it do to you? Okay? Now, NAT stands for Network Address Translation. It's a method used throughout the internet and peripherals that you use daily that allows you to basically change the normal path that an address follows to circumnavigate some problems that you may anticipate running into, okay? I won't get into the technology of it, but it's basically the program sort of puts together a public in-house, there's a contradiction, server of its own, and everything dumps into this holding bucket, and it gets redistributed in the way they want to redistribute. So let me give you an idea of what happens. The NAT system is basically pretty sound, but it does have its weaknesses, and it has its moments that will drive you absolutely nuts. Let me buy a nickel. The Echolink program that we use every day, guys and gals, has an NAT circuit in it, a program in it, that was put in by John Taylor on one of his later releases of the program. I think it's 902 and up. And what it was intended to do was for you guys and gals and all of us that were having trouble with the port forwarding situation of Echolink, the forwarding, through your router, port forwarding of 5198, 5199, 5200, was circumnavigated by the NAT program and allowed you, even if you didn't have the port forwarding to be set up, that the program would function. And this was nice, until all of a sudden you wake up one morning and, things aren't working. Let me buy another nickel. And that is basically, you know, you'll be in a conversation like we are here with the server tonight, and all of a sudden your audio will disappear. The second thing will happen, you'll look up to your user list on the right side of the EchoLink program, and you'll find out that the caret that indicates who's transmitting is fixed, and it never disappears. Everything has locked up on you. And the only way you're going to get out of that is to close the program out and reopen it and reconnect to the server. That is an NAT problem. And it can be fixed so that it doesn't happen to you by a couple of steps we'll be getting into here in a minute. Another pause. Okay, so the next question is, what is still important to why is it important to configure your port forwarding in the router? And that is because of the example that I just gave. Whether you want to rely on NAT or not, what you should do to save your frustration factor is to go ahead and port forward the three ports that I mentioned for EchoLink in your router, and should be set up and forwarded in your firewall setting on your operating computer, which normally happens pretty automatically. But the router, you have to manually do it. And if you do that, it will rely on the path that's designated by the configuration that you just made and not the NAT system, and you won't get hung up with your knickers. All right, next question is, what happens with a momentary power outage on your router? And why, with that question, is it so necessary to have a static IP address? Let me buy a nickel. It's a very simple thing to do, to go into your computer, and all you have to do is research this. There's a million pages out on the internet on how to set a static IP address. And I'm talking, you're setting in your computer the internal IP address. That's the one that is used to communicate between your router and your computer and back and forth. And it normally has a number like 192.168.0. .100 or something like that, okay? So you go in and you set it up for a static IP address. You get away from the NAT problem, and you get away from some other problems, such as what happens to your computer when you and your wife have separate computers? Now think about this. And you turn them on, you turn them off at night when you both go to bed, you know, go to sleep. Well, let's take the situation where she gets up early in the morning and earlier than you, and she turns on her computer first. Her computer doesn't have EchoLink on it. You come in and you turn on your computer and your EchoLink isn't working, and it's because when these things were asleep and then they got turned back on again, I'm talking about the computers on and off, the router reassigned the IP address to both of your machines in this example. She got your IP address or another one, whatever, and you, when you turned yours on, got another IP address, either her old one or another one, but none of them, at least as far as your computer is concerned, match the IP address that you had to put into your port forwarding page in the router in order to make EchoLink work. So, you have a static app address, you can turn off your computer, you can come back in 3 months, turn it back on, and no matter what's happened, you will still be using the same address. The router will still have that same address in your port forwarding and your home free. Then the last point here that should be made, I'm going to buy another nickel, is why you can only use one outside IP address per Echolink Connect. George touched on this problem. If any of us, and I do a lot of this, use a number of computers on Echolink at the same time, you're faced with a problem that your ISP, your server provider, only gives you one outside world address. Now, you can get another one from the IP address, and in fact, you can get a couple more if you want to pay for them. And I don't know what it is anymore, but it used to be something like $10 a month from your server in order to get a second, and then another $10 for a third, and, you know, so on and so forth. The Echolink servers themselves that you first connect to when you turn on your program are monitoring two things. They are monitoring your call sign, and they are monitoring the IP address that you're using for that connect to that call sign, okay? So, if you have a second computer coming in with the same IP address, all of a sudden you have two guys with the same name, same number, trying to play the game in the ball yard at the same time, and the service says, that's not going to work, and it doesn't. So, another nickel time. So what you do here to get around the funny farm is to make sure that your second or third or fourth or whatever number of computers you're running on Echolink at the same time all have different addresses. And instead of paying the ISP extra money for new addresses, you use a proxy, a public proxy or a private proxy or something. And that's available right on your Echolink program. So you can dial it up at your choice. There are some very good ones out there that are very substantial and have no regulations to them, timing and mode operation and so on. So computer number two has a proxy address. Computer number three has a proxy address. They're all different than your home address that you're using on your main computer, and you are home smiling and not getting all frustrated. Let me turn it back to you, Gary, and see if you'd like to pick up any questions on that. Something dear to our heart, I would think. KY6V, over.
7-0 comment.
GH comment.
Okay, we had two comments in there, 7-0, and did not catch the last one, so can you come in again?
Victor Hotel.
Okay, Victor Hotel. Anybody else? All right, let's continue with 7-0. Go right ahead, sir.
Well, thank you, Gary. Well, so what I've just learned from Gordon in the Internet of Things, I've learned that unless you want Echolink to order another gallon of milk for the refrigerator every time you transmit and wind up having milk all over the floor, or maybe have an extra home delivery of wild exotic animals every time you set the alarm clock to go to bed, you really do need to take time to read up on IP address conflicts. We need to be sure before close of TIN tonight to at least get to topic 12 on page 17 before adjourning, but I know time's running. So back to you, KC2GA, NL70, over.
All right, thank you, sir. Victor Hotel, you're in there, and let's hear from you.
KC2GA in the group, KF5VH. Good evening, everyone. I wanted to tack on the back end of Gordon's comment that there's one more thing you have to do if you're going to put a static IP address in your computer, and that is you must make sure that that address is not in the range where DHCP addresses are assigned. You have to have it outside the range that the router's handing out. I get around this problem. I go the other way. I take the MAC address of the computer and I put it in the router and say, whenever you see this MAC address, assign this address to that device. And that way you don't have to worry about whether it's in or out of DHCP range, because your computer DHCPs, but it always gets the same address. Back to net, KF5VH.
All right, thank you, sir. Anybody else, any further comments? Okay, nothing heard. And as they say, the old clock on the wall, there it goes. That was the old clock on the wall. The old clock on the wall is ticking, and time is running down. So let's move right ahead, and let's go to topic 12, shall we? We're going to be talking about the Raspberry Pi upgrades and resources. Now, we have breaking news on the Raspberry Pi. If you don't know what that is, that's a small board computer. This year's March release is a new Raspberry Pi 3B Plus. It has a faster CPU, multiband Wi-Fi, and requires the newest downloads from Raspberry Pi, the Raspberry Pi site, to run. Now, the improvements are significant for such a small computer. The price is about $20 more. The Pi 3B Plus also still comes with the soldered GPIO 40-pin header already soldered on. Now, I've got an older Raspberry Pi, and it is just a fascinating little machine, and it's a gas to play with. This new version is supposed to be just mind-blowing at what it can do. Let me buy a nickel, and I'm going to tell you a few more things. Recent Raspberry Pi upgrades have been of significantly higher quality and more responsive to recent security needs for Wi-Fi and browsers. Speed with the quad-core Pi B is impressive, and is only a small delay equivalent to half a decade ago when displaying many web pages. Now, here's some of the recent improvements. Stretch addresses on the WPA2 security vulnerability found with the Jesse Billion Linux distribution. Stretch is a more stable release and does not corrupt the operating system. Recent upgrades make burning the SIM card easier. I know sometimes there had been some troubles with that in the past. It took a little bit of effort to get an OS on that SIM card other than what they call noobs, which comes with it. A major difficulty reported for getting Pi up and running now seems very easy to get around with after research in the NO70 shack. So the secret above ground research laboratory of NO70 has put this through stasis. Some people report great difficulty burning a card in Windows 10, especially the 64 gig SIM cards. You can get around this by using a powered USB strip for the card writer and then plugging the SD card into the USB strip instead of into the Windows 10 computer, then format the card as FAT32. Working format setup is especially useful for 64 gig SIM cards. So you buy a nickel. The Noobs distribution is probably the easiest installation for new Pi users. It simply requires copying in the operating system into a properly formatted SD card. Otherwise, you'll be burning images, sometimes using a lot of Linux shell command lines, and I have been there. To reliably use multiple Raspberry Pis, you must use and set multiple static addresses for each device, including IOTA appliances on your shack network. This will help give you trouble-free operation. NO70 has some more information on multimedia on the Pi, and just in time, too, because we are running tight for time. So NO70, tell us about multimedia on this wonderful Raspberry Pi.
KC2GA and the South Park TIN NO70. It is amazing what has transpired for audiovisual possibilities on a $35 to $50 credit card size computers. Other distributions for the Raspberry Pi include functionalities for different purposes for the Pi, such as audio and video playback. Now, there is discussion about the legality, Gary and Annette, of playing commercial videos in Linux. However, your own video creations you can do without any licensing concerns. Now, there is a lack of audio players and video players in the native Debian distributions, and some copyright licensing issues have affected the ready-made distros like some of those that have been used for the past few years. They got hit hard by a licensing conflict. Again, though, if you have rights, the question has been, how do you get to play audio and video? Well, for a very effective audio player that can be used to play a variety of media formats that you own, there is a new multi-format file media player that is very powerful called ALSA Player, that's ALSAPLAYER, and another called MPC with MPD, and those do have a capability of playing a wider variety of file formats. And you can even use these players in a Python program to create a mixtape, even using the different formats for selections in the same mix, and bind them to push buttons for play, reverse, and forward directions, and maybe even mount the buttons in a cardboard shoebox portable player or a chassis or some type. You can look at how to do this on how-to websites. Back to you, Gary, KSU-TGA, NL70.
Well, thank you. I'll tell you, there's really, it seems like there's nothing this little thing can't do. And, you know, I think people just keep finding, you know, more and more innovative ways to use it. And it's always fun. And, George, while I've got you there, just if people aren't familiar with us, what's the going price for the latest version?
For the Raspberry Pi 3B Plus, you mean, Gary, over?
Correct, for the Raspberry Pi 3.
Well, the U3B Plus, I have seen two prices. One is that it's the same price as the old 3B. Now, this is going to be confusing with their model names. There's the 3 and the 3B. This is the 3B Plus that has just come out with the increased performance. I've seen that the price for the 3B Plus is the same price as for the 3B. I have seen other places, especially from some well-known overseas sources that have been very traditional, reliable sources, where there seems to be a $25 premium over that amount. I'd say let the buyer do their research, Gary. KSU-TGA, NL70.
Thank you, George. The bottom line is that they're cheap. you're not going to spend an awful lot for them. I mean, we're talking well under $100, and just a great little useful toy to have for a little bit of money. All right, we've been taking a wide-ranging and occasionally humorous look at our shack procedures and operations. Hopefully, we've encouraged you to enjoy your hobby even more and by giving you the confidence to tackle some of the problems that you've had. Remember that the more successes you have in your shack and the more you give your community your server, the more you'll enjoy your hobby and the longer we'll have you included in our roster of active and engaged operators. That is true. I want to thank everybody who joined us tonight. This has been a good night and has been very enjoyable. And this has been SouthCars. SCARS VoIP net schedules and general information may be found on the scarsvoip.com website. I want to give special thanks to my motley crew tonight. Pardon me, that would be KY6V, W4RFJ, and NO70. You guys have made this the most enjoyable net and most knowledgeable, too. I really appreciate your expertise there. I'm KC2GA, and we're closing this VoIP session. I want to thank everybody once again. This net is now closed.
KC2GA, KY6V, and NO70, net is closed. But I ask the recording continue with KY6V's permission. And I have a special request if KY6V would be kind enough for us to hear his voice for a moment longer to read the list of available small board computers like the Pi as listed on page 17, just so that we have the list read. Is that permissible? KC2GA and KY6V in 07 over.
KC2GA, go right ahead.
Why, certain wa. Your desire is my command. George, are you ready? I haven't turned any of the recorders off. Over.
Still running and ready. Thank you for asking, Gordon. KY6V and 070.
And I thought I was going to get out of this one. Just kidding. Guys and gals, here's a partial list of modern small computer boards collectively known as SBCs. Sierra Bravo Charlie's. And it's worth a ham's operating time to spend some time researching which is the best for you, obviously. The important thing here is to choose one and get active right away with one of the SBCs. After all, and this is sort of George's footer, if you will, after all, we all want to have knowledge of at least the equivalent of the third grader in school, don't we? Question mark. His words, verbatim. So, Raspberry Pi Zero and Pi 3, 3B, and now we have added the 3B Plus with Broadcom architecture. We've got BeagleBone with the T1 architecture. We've got Banana Pi with all winner A20s and QB Board 4. That's with Odroid X4. And boy, this list goes on. It says to be 2 to 4 times faster than the Raspberry Pi 3. That's something to think about. Single board computer, Pi Banana, Pi Orange, Pi Chana, my goodness, RO board, Pi Zero Wire, Pi Zero Wireless with pre-soldered 40-pin, and boy, this goes on and on and on. GP10 header for remote control and digital input and output signal processing with robotics. STEM, Household IoT, Internet of Things, and other operations. Rock Pro 64. Well, you got a lot to scan here to figure out what you're going to do. Lati Panda, Tinker Board, UD00, Lemacker, a guitar, a general purpose SBC, but which is a model name only and not limited to guitar amp use, we might add. High Keys 960 chip. $9 computer, and that's now discontinued. The Perella 16-core SB Super Computer. I bet you everybody's just writing this down just as fast as they could, George. and that is reducing in popularity. So, the golden vision of George N070 at the bottom of this list says, you haven't heard of Moore's Law. If you haven't, it says there is an increasing capability of putting more processors on a single board. But that technology is reaching the limit of Moore's Law. I rest my case. George, how did I do and can we wrap it? N070 from KY6V in South Cars.
All right. KC2GA. Well, if you ever saw the movie The Little Shop of Horrors, you remember that plant in The Little Shop of Horrors going, feed me. That's what my stomach's doing right now. So I'm gonna get in there and feed it before it eats me. Great net tonight, guys. And once again, my thanks to everybody. Really enjoyed it. And let's do it again sometime. I'll say 7-3 to everybody. You guys have yourselves a great week. KC2GA clear.